Hey, everybody, we are back on That's Criminal with John Stamp, TCP for short. I'm an acronyms guy, been in the government for 20 years, so it just kind of comes with the vocabulary at this point. So TCP, and I hope you guys had as much fun as I did over the holiday. December was nuts. It was an absolute blur. We decided to take the wee babes to the Big Island of Hawaii. And just like has happened the first time I went to the Big Island, I went to Kona about 15 years ago. Red Five and the big guy did not want to come back. I didn't either the first time. First time I tried to talk my wife into giving it all up and going to work on a coffee farm. And she said no, which was very smart at that time. But this time, there's not just me. There's three out of the four of us all in favor of putting up a tent on the beach, never leaving the island again. And probably, thankfully, the brains of the outfit, the lovely Erica Stamp, managed to talk us out of it, mostly by explaining the harsh realities of the life we live. So the TCP is back because Erica made it happen. Otherwise, I would probably be sitting in a beach right now trying to figure out how to do a podcast from a tent. Actually, wait, hold on. Before I go on, this cracks me up because Cohen just did, the Red Five just did this the other day. So Red Five is Cohen. He's my five-year-old. Red Five for obvious reasons if you've checked out the IG. But so Red Five comes and gets all snuggly about 4 days ago. It's late. It's getting to be movie time. So he usually starts passing out around 9 or 10 and on a weekend, not a school night. And he gets all snuggled up on my shoulder like he's getting ready to pass out. And he just looks at me. And in the most sincere voice I have ever heard him, the little guy muster, he goes, "Dad, I love you." Like, "Oh, that's sweet, buddy. I love you too. Thanks." He goes, "But I love mom more." He's like, "Yeah, okay. That's a little soul crushing, but no, it makes sense. It probably should be that way, right? Mom's more important." He's like, "No, it's not that. It's she's smarter than you are." I'm like, that is a fact. That is a factual statement. And I was like, "Cohen, I got nothing, buddy. I cannot argue with you one bit on that." So that's my boy. And I'm still laughing about that. It cracked me up so much. It's taken me a minute to recover, but I just thought you guys would like to share how the dynamics of that Stamp household works. So moving on, TCP, we are back. Last year I had so much fun doing this. I decided I'd come back and talk to a bunch of people. And to do so, I've got a pretty great lineup, both in true crime and in fiction coming up. I wanted to expand a little bit on the fiction side of the house. True crime is awesome and all, very interesting and intriguing, but it also can get a little dark. So I wanted to make sure we've got a little more artistry mixed into the true crime life this coming season. So I hope you continue to enjoy it as we move on. And another announcement, the boys decided that we have a new logo on the TCP. Some of you might have seen it. Last year, I put a couple polls up trying out a couple things, and they decided what the new logo is. It will be attached to the show notes, and it'll be the new cover for the podcast starting next week. Next, I need to take a minute and give a big thank you to all of you who have supported, downloaded, Brother's Keeper, reviewed Brother's Keeper. I've got some great notes, some great comments. So far, Alex and Charlie, the charmers that they are, have been very well received. And like he did with spoilers, Chaz Mandala nailed it with the job on narration. The way he manages to take that written word and really make it pop when you're listening to it is something I really, really appreciate him. And both of us really appreciate you guys, your support so far. So thank you for Brother's Keeper and such a warm welcome it's received. And it's a new platform on Audible. And one more thing before we get to it tonight. As always, don't forget, like, subscribe, and rate the TCP, and I will send you a free ebook. DM me on IG at That's Criminal Podcast, or email me at John at John Stamp Writer. Try to talk. And I will send you either Brother's Keeper, Shattered Circle, or Wraith of Shelter Mount. So tonight, all right, let's get to talking to people. Tonight, I'm going to talk to Stan Mitchell, former Marine, journalist, author, and podcaster. He's authored 11 books, both in the fiction and nonfiction world, including the Danny Acuff series and the Nick Woods series. So, Stan, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It is good to talk to you. To start, as we said, you've served in the Marines, and when I was looking at your background, you at 17 went to the Marine recruiter and demanded that you be an infantryman. Probably not the most common of requests of the 17 year olds looking to serve. What was it that you decided, that's my job, that's what I'm going to do?
Oh man, I don't. I guess it's because I was 17, but I don't know. I jokingly tell people I think I had small man syndrome or I had something to prove, but I wanted to be a Marine and I wanted to do what I envisioned Marines doing, and so I wanted to be guaranteed infantry.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's I mean, that's harder than most MOSs, but at 17 years old, you're like, what's the hardest thing I can do? That sounds like fun. I'm going to go do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Know? Yep.
So you mentioned that you lived it, you breathed it. But as you got further on, you just kind of attacked it as a lifestyle. But now looking back, you kind of wish you'd slowed down and enjoyed it in the moment more. What I was wondering as I was reading up on you was how far down the line did you get that where you thought that, like, was it immediate or was it like you hit 40 and you're like, I could have enjoyed it for a minute more?
Yeah, I think I was probably 30 or so before it really started to sink in. And but definitely by the time, you know, I'm 45, and I think by the time I was 40, I realized a lot of the guys I joined in were getting out at 37, 38 years old. And so I was like, man, the guys who just relaxed and enjoyed it, a lot of them stayed in. And, you know, we were talking offline before this, but I was the guy that I was always studying the knowledge I wanted. I couldn't wait to get corporal. I couldn't wait to go to, you know, corporal's course. I wanted to be the honor graduate. And then I wanted to, you know, compete on these boards for Marine of the Quarter. I wanted to get sergeant as fast as possible. I tell people that, you know, to this day, I'm one of the few Marines without a Marine Corps tattoo because I wanted to go Force Recon. And after maybe 10, 20 years, I wanted to join the CIA. I was just lived it, breathed it. And I was so living in the future that I didn't live in the present. And some of the guys who just relaxed, I didn't even drink back then. Some of the guys that just relaxed while I was out lifting or studying, they stayed in. And so I ended up burning out after 4 years and, you know, had a great time, got out of sergeant, which was still quite an accomplishment in the infantry. And at that time, I'm not sure how the MOSs are these days. So I'm proud of everything I did, but I think I realized that in life, you can't burn the candle on both ends and give that much and without eventually just burning out. And so you got to have balance in life. But, you know, when you're 17 or 19 or 21, that's not something most of us know very well.
Yeah. It's just hard and fast at seven, you know, that 18 to 25 demographic is just like, if you make it through that, it's like, whew, you know, sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess
yeah.
It depends on who you are, but it's like, wow, I did some dumb things in that time.
Yeah, know? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's funny. Just as you mentioned that it kind of struck me a little bit. It wasn't so much the drive to get this promotion, that award, but I love the whole police world when I first started. And it was I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to, you know, I want to be patrol, I want to be a detective, I want to be a negotiator, I want to do this and blah, 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 blah. And I got to, you know, ways down the road, it's like, you know, if I had just taken a few more years and you know, stopped and enjoyed it and absorbed it, it was like, I was always like, oh, that looks cool, I want to try that. It's like I say that I have career ADHD because every time I see something that looks fun, I just run towards it, you know?
So yep.
it's cost me a little bit over the years, but it's been fun. But I do sometimes be like, I should have just enjoyed it a little bit, just kind of absorbed what I was doing at the time. But yeah, I'm still having fun now. So I'm not going to,
yeah, absolutely.
Can't argue
absolutely.
With it. no regrets with an A.
Yeah, absolutely.
I ask this of pretty much everybody. What What was your favorite memory, and what do you miss most about serving?
Yeah. So on my favorite memory, just a couple of things that come to mind was just the brotherhood. You know, you can't really find that in the civilian world like you can in the military. They bring people of all backgrounds and you know, personalities and hobbies and interests. And I tell people, you know, a lot of the guys I'm still in contact with, we realize that we don't have a lot in common. We still talk about military stuff, but, you know, they like this or they like that. And it takes people that aren't, that maybe in the civilian world, you'd say hello and shake hands and maybe see at a community event here or there, but you wouldn't hang out with these type of people, and it pushes them together. And you learn to, you know, I miss that kind of brotherhood, that it takes people that don't even have similar interests and you end up being basically blood brothers. I miss that. It's hard to get that in the civilian world. It's very, very hard to get that. And so I definitely miss that the most. Probably my favorite memory was we were lucky enough to our platoon. It's pure luck, but we were selected to be what was called a covering force for the Force Recon unit that deployed out at in the Mediterranean in 97. And so basically they have about 18 guys that mostly carry MP5s, and which is a small submachine gun used for hostage rescue. And they just needed good riflemen. And so our platoon was selected to go through what was called covering force school for a couple of weeks. And then we basically got to train a lot with these force recon guys. And then they often worked with the SEALs. So it was just, you know, being 19 and seeing these force recon guys and SEALs who were nothing like the infantry guys, you know, the infantry guys all standing around acting tough, talking tough, etc. And the force recon and SEALs were so humble, and they look different, they walk different. And if you've seen them at a bar or something, you probably wouldn't even have known they were Marines or SEALs. And I learned a lot from just like watching them. I can't say I got to be great friends with them or anything, but we were just, you know, a platoon of 20 plus dudes with long weapons that were there to help protect them while they had the short range submachine guns. But we got to fast rope with them and see them, and just, you know, to be 19 and see these, most of these guys were 25, 28, 30. Many of them had done at least four or five deployments out to sea. Some of them had seen a little action in Somalia and other places. And so I got to be around older, more experienced operators. And so that was definitely probably the favorite experience. And, you know, we had talked offline. There are a lot of things in the infantry that were not fun, from sleeping in the cold or wet or mud, but they say it builds character. So those tough times, you never forget them. And then even when things are bad in the civilian world, though they're never as bad as it could have been there, you're like, yeah, this is nothing. I remember the time when I had XYZ, and people just look at you like you're crazy. So
yeah, it could be worse.
Lots of those. Yeah. It can always be worse.
Yeah, I guess it makes it a little harder to get stressed out when that's collective suffering and accomplishment all in the same time, you know.
Yeah, it should be. Yeah. I still find myself getting stressed out, but I think that's just our personality type maybe or something. I still want to be the best at whatever I'm doing, but I should be like, yeah, there's no reason to be stressed out, but
yeah, can always
perfectionism
be
is difficult. It's impossible to attain.
Yeah. I think that's probably genetic. I've always been amazed by those investigators that you run into, that it's the attention to detail and the way they can think and sequence and think strategically. But every time you look at their reports, they're just spectacular. The courts rave about them. And I was never that good. I would always look at those investigators that just their product was just impeccable. And I was like, I don't know how they do that. I start on one thing. It's lucky if I'm lucky if I make it 7 minutes before I'm like scrolling YouTube or something. It's just it's the attention to detail is not there. But that was it. I was just never.
You were designed to be an author, it sounds like.
I guess, man. Yeah, that I will tell you, the career ADHD helps.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. So that you get out of the Marines, and you go into journalism, and you ended up running your own newspaper. How does a mid 20 year old end up being like, I'm going to start a newspaper today?
Yeah, it's a great story. I had, after college, was in journalism and started at a weekly newspaper for maybe a year or so. And I didn't realize then, I was kind of like you as far as wanting to go up the ladder. I didn't realize then what I had, I guess, if I'm honest. And I loved the pace of the weekly newspaper. But in my mind, I wanted to get to a daily newspaper. And there was a town of Oak Ridge of like 30,000 people. And then from there, I wanted to just go to the next big paper, the next one, the next one, the next one. But anyway, so I get to the Oak Ridger, and which is the name of the newspaper in Oak Ridge, and it's a daily newspaper 5 days a week, and the pace is different, the stories are different, and I was like, man, I kind of miss like that hometown feel of a weekly newspaper where it's not all bad news, where you do better, longer, in-depth profile type stories. And yeah, so basically, I was at the age of 27, and just a few things happened that at that time had no kids. And it was like, man, if I was ever going to do it, I really just need like two computers, a camera, and a contract with a local printer, of which there were many. And there are several printers, I guess, in the Knoxville area I could have used. And I just started thinking of it. And I guess I was always born to be someone that worked for themselves, but I was like, I think I can do this. And so at the time I talked to my wife and we were like, I thought I could do it for $20,000. That was the price of a new car back then. This has obviously been a while, but so 2004, I believe. And it's like, we had no kids. And it's like, if you're ever going to start a company, why not do it when you're 27? I knew journalism. I knew people in Oak Ridge. I just had faith that I could do it. And so, we took the plunge. So that's how you started at 27, because as you think about it, now that I'm 45 and I've got a stepson and a family, if someone was like, hey, we want to start a newspaper, start a business or all, it's totally different situation, because you can get wiped out at a young age, still have time to recover. Yep. You can't do that when you're, in your mid 40s. You got to be much more careful and think about things such as, retirement, 401ks, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. We got to be responsible once we get to that.
Yeah, exactly.
Once we get to that age. I remember it was, I didn't become an adult until I was 36 years old. I absolutely remember it.
Yeah. Oh, you'll have to share that.
No, it's the first, when the big guy was born, I was like, oh, I got responsible now. Like, cause it,
yeah,
when you don't have kids, it's like, yeah. You're just something crazy comes up at work. Like, I'm going to go do this. And you just know that the wife's going to be like, okay, you're gone for a few months, but I got this. No problem. Right. And it's not until it's like, well, who's going to change the diapers? I got to go to work. It's like, diapers. I got to change diapers.
Yep.
Oh. So, yeah, I was like, okay, I got to be responsible now. I got time to be an adult, time to settle down.
Yeah. I think looking back now, especially now that I have a stepson, it's like when you have a kid and no matter what their age is, you're already thinking of everything from health insurance to college fund to whatever. So I think it's just like, you're right. Once you get that added responsibility, it really does reduce the kind of crazy chances leaping, will the net appear or not? Well, you're less likely to leap because it might not appear.
Yep. Yeah. Cause then it's not just you anymore.
Exactly. Yep.
Yep. But that was interesting. Yeah, I do. I can pinpoint it. I'm like 36 years old. Boom. There, man. There's, hey, I grew up, mom. Sort of. Yep.
So we never fully grow up.
I'm not planning on it. There's a difference between adult and a grown up.
Absolutely. I like that.
I'm going to hold on to that. Hold on. Mark that tape.
Yeah. No kid.
So the writing thing, has it always been there? Were you the guy run around, well, in between night runs, rucks, and lifting? Were you the guy with a notebook in the corner of the barracks?
Yeah. So I mostly read a lot then, but it was there from the childhood. I think I put on my website my mom and I can't recall if I was in fourth grade or fifth grade, but I still have the notes of a story I started in fourth or fifth grade, handwritten, spiral bound. Little notebook, just like you got in school. And I don't remember the book, or there was some book I read at that age. And I was like, this book is trash. This is not any good. And there were several boring ones I'd read. And I'm like, I can do this. And for whatever reason, I was big into, Native American heritage. I got a little bit in my past. And so maybe I had seen I can't even remember the name of the Western now, but I was like, I can write a book about young Native Americans. And so I wrote 20 something pages at that, which I still have saved because I think at some point, you know, I might be famous enough that someone's like, we want to see, and maybe someone would read it and figure out who knows what third dimensional, whatever. But yeah,
it'll be the rough notes auctioned off at Christie's or something like that.
I hope so.
That's what you gotta aim for.
As a writer, you have to be just slightly delusional enough to believe such things, even though it's completely not true. But I wrote a lot all the way from that age on. In the military, I didn't write a ton. I started a book, but I was reading the whole time. I was mostly in the military focused on. I think by that point, I was living and breathing the Marine Corps. And I just, like I said, I wanted to work my way toward the CIA. And I just wanted to serve my country. I thought I could be good at it. And, as I said, I got burned out on that and learned some things along the way. But once I was out of that and in college, I was again writing again. And in fact, you'll laugh about this, John, but my buddy and I, we co-wrote a book, and I think it was my junior or senior year, and we were trying to get agents and publishers to look at it, and we had one bite on it. And this was how, you know, when you're young, you're confident. This is how stupid I was. But my buddy and I, they wanted us to make a change on one of the chapters, and we hadn't talked to a whole lot of people. And we were like, man, we got this list. We got like 10 other people we're still going to reach out to. And I kid you not, John, we refused to make any changes. So you know how this goes. So then we go down the rest of the list and we're like, oh man, no one else is reaching out to us. So we reach back out to that person, which I don't even remember the name now. But of course, they probably realized at that point, these are young, arrogant guys. But we thought we were, you know, we had not been humbled yet, and we thought we were great writers. And I'm sure the advice was great. And so if you're ever that young person doing that, you might want to make the changes and listen to somebody. Yeah. But after that, it was probably 12 years of starting about 30 different books before I actually got something published after that. So, but I always laugh at that because when you're that young, you just think you can take the world on. And so.
Yeah. Well, I salute your artistic integrity. Your business sense, but the book, not so much.
The book is now still unpublished and in a drawer somewhere. And I always thought at some point, I still like the idea, but I thought, well, I'm going to reach out to my old friend who I haven't talked to in years and just be like, hey, can I just have the rights to it? I'll give you half or whatever, because we had some disagreements on the ending, but it's still a finished book. But if I read it, it's probably garbage. I'd probably rewrite most of it anyway.
Yeah, but that's the one. That's the one you dust off a little bit and just send it out again. See what happens when it makes the cycle now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's funny. So so you're doing the newspaper thing running your own business. That's awesome. Who came first, Danny or Nick?
A great question. So Nick came first. So Nick Woods, I had read some books by Stephen Hunter, and obviously he's got the sniper Bob Lee Swagger, and loved that character. And always in the back of my mind, you know, kind of wanted to be a sniper, but you know, probably didn't have it in me. But I knew sniper books sold well, and everyone, there's a mystique about them. And so I had this crazy idea of a sniper who does a secret mission, in this case, Afghanistan, back in the 80s. And I just had this idea back in my mind where it's like, man, like we know the US was supplying anti-air missiles to the Mujahideen back then to fight the Russians, to get them out of their country. Just as the Russians supplied weapons against the U.S. in Vietnam. And I had this idea. I was like, man, so we sent these anti-air things. You can find lots of reports that there were CIA folks who helped, you know, basically almost hand carry these things in on donkey trails, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, you know, what if there was like this really elite Spetsnaz team that was going around taking out some of these villagers? And someone in the CIA was like, yeah, it's great we're shooting down these helos, but like, we got to take this team out. And then I was like, how would you do it? And it's like, man, what if the US sent a sniper team in? And as that got going in my mind, I was just imagining it. And I was like, you know, if you did that, what if it was like, hey, we got to close this down? And what if, you know, the dirty CIA guys, like, we know there's a mole. Let's do two things at one time. We're going to sell these guys out, give away their info. and we're going to see who's leaking it. So we'll find the mole. We can use the mole. And if these guys pass, you know, oh well. And so that was kind of the beginning of the idea. And then in my mind, I envisioned how that sniper would survive it. He would know he was sold out. He would come back to the States. He would keep his mouth shut. And then all is well until a investigative reporter years and years later starts digging on it and finds out the story. And so that's kind of what creates the scene of this guy that has to be on the run. The reporter has to be on the run, and then they end up working together. And so it took 12 years, but I then stuck this, you know, Southern tough sniper, and I team him up with a guy from New York who's super liberal, disagrees with all violence. And I'm like, wouldn't that be amazing? Put to the absolute two total opposite. You take the private school guy from New York who doesn't believe in violence, and you throw him with like the redneck from the South who's a Marine Corps sniper, and let's just see what happens. And so, yeah, that's kind of the skeleton of that story.
Yeah, that contrast is awesome. Yeah, that works.
I was fortunate on that one. That was one of those. It took a long time to come together, but I'm pretty proud of that one. And I guess the fact it took so long to come together was both it was a blessing and a curse. And the funny thing about that, you probably relate to this, John. I wasn't some genius writer. It had an ending that kind of like the bad guy gets away. So I wrote this book. It was just going to be a one book thing. Took me forever to get it out. I didn't even know if I'd have the courage to get it out by then. Like I said, I'd been really humbled. And but I put it out and it does well. And everyone's like, man, we're ready for book two. And I'm like, what do you mean book two? There is no book two.
Here's a book two.
And so all these people are like, dude, book two, book two. And that one book basically made enough income that I've become a full-time author off of it. And I'm like, man, book, I don't know, like, what's book two? And so here was the thing that was it's almost heartbreaking looking back, but I was rushed into getting a book two put out. And you can't spend 12 years on one book and write another one in less than a year and expect a book two to be as good as book one. And so it wasn't as good. I've made modifications to it since then. So it's like the trajectory of the, you know, sky high author career quickly went back down. And I learned, you know, a tough thing about American culture, which is that America loves winners, and Americans love great books, and they love winner teams, whether it's whatever football team, whatever fighter. They want you in the ring, they want you on the field, and they want you to win. And when you're not winning, you know, there's not a ton of loyalty. So it was crushing to honestly put out a second book that wasn't as good. And for folks to be like, you know, he's a one-hit wonder. It wasn't that good. So I kind of went through a deep, dark period where, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to get a day job. I'm not going to be like the next great author. I'm just going to have to dig deep and keep writing. And this is a gut check time. And, you know, I've been writing ever since then. And thankfully, sales have slowly but surely been working their way back up. And now 11 books later, we are where we are. But I often think about, especially like mixed martial arts or football, you know, we build these champions up in our minds, and we throw them back out. We want them to fight. We want them to play hurt. We want them to do whatever. And when they get hurt worse or they lose, I mean, the honest truth is most times in American culture, we kind of discard them and move to the next hero. So I probably went way deeper than I should have on that. The absolute truth.
Well, that's I don't put myself as a tier one author by any means, but when you go out to signings or you go out to book conferences, and the people are coming up, or you see them 1 year and they're like, I'm working on this, and next year you're like, hey man, where's your book? And it's one of those things. Whenever they ask, like, how do I do this? You'd say, here's your block of time every day. You sit down and you type, and even if it's vomit, you keep typing. Because there's nobody that's going to care that you almost wrote a book. There's nobody that's going to care. You're
absolutely right.
Nobody cares. Yes. And the writing thing, you know, you think of, like, I'm still waiting. I feel like I will have arrived if I've got like my tweed jacket with the reinforced leather elbows and I'm being shown around, you know, Times Square or something like that. But, it's supposed to be all artistic until you start doing it. And it's the most blue collar job you could have.
Yes.
I mean, your hands aren't getting dirty, but, you're the only one working, and nobody cares if you don't accomplish it. There's nobody that's going to care.
Yeah. I once had a journalism professor say that everyone thinks that journalism or writing, he wrote books as well, is the life of an artist. He said it's not, it's manufacturing. And he said, until you realize it's manufacturing, you're never going to succeed. So if you're waiting for inspiration to strike, you're not going to make it. You have to sit down and make inspiration. It has to become a job, and it has to become, and I think that's another thing. Sometimes, especially new writers, it's like, I'm not enjoying it right now. I'm just going to wait a week or two or whatever. I mean, any professional writer will tell you there are times they write things that they weren't having fun. You're finishing the book. You have to finish that scene or that chapter. And that's the difference in a professional and an amateur. Is a professional writes when they're hurt, and an amateur is like, I'm just going to go do this or I'm going to do that. And so, yeah, you're dead on everything you said.
Yeah, if the brain's sideways, it doesn't matter, because the job's still got to really get done, or you're going to be staring at yourself.
Well, if you have a contract in place or something like that too, like, you got to deliver. So,
yeah. And you can only look at yourself if you don't get it done, which makes it even worse.
Yeah, you're right. And even if you don't have a contract in place, the reality is, the public wants to read good books, and they don't care if 10 people wrote it. They don't care if it's your name on the title or whatever. If you have too long of a delay between books, people move on. People forget. There are hungry authors out there. They're going to find a new series, et cetera. So it's like, do you want it? And if you want it, you got to go get it. That's just the reality.
Yep. You
if you don't, someone else will.
Yeah. Well, I guess. And then I guess the biggest fear is like, well, what happens when you run out of ideas?
I won't have
which
that
hasn't
problem.
Happened yet. It hasn't happened yet.
If you're like me, you, it's like, am I going to have, is 40 plus more years enough time to write all the ideas?
Yeah. I've got a notebook by my headboard. I've got a notebook in my office. I got a notebook. I'm in the truck. I got so many notes in my phone. I look at them like, how hammered was I when I wrote that down? Like, I don't even,
Well, and I think the real skill is you have these 50 to 100 ideas that you want to write. And it's like, okay, which one fits a genre? Which one is marketable? Which one will actually succeed? Because that's the other thing between the difference in a professional and an amateur is we can go write things that are fun to write. And sometimes, oh my word, I'm finishing up Nick Woods 5, the fifth books in the series. And it's been so hard because the war, it happens in Ukraine. The war in Ukraine happened. That wasn't part of the original plot. I had to tear it apart. I mean, it's been 2+ years and I'm dying to write so many other things, including a Danny Acuff book I've got half done. But it's like, if you bounce around and write what you want to write all the time, you're never going to get anywhere, because I know what I need to finish. I need to finish Nick Woods 5, which I've promised to fans, which people are demanding. And so it's like, you can go write these little niche things or other things you want to do or fun. You want to do this short story or, oh, I have this new idea. I have this new character. Well, I mean, like, how many series are you going to do? Because we know that the route to success is typically a long series involving the same author, same world. And so it's like, are you going to try to do 5 series in 5 worlds, 10 series in 10 worlds? Because that's going to take a lot of effort, because it's going to be a minimum of 3 books per. How long does it take you to write a book? It's about a year per book. You're talking 15 years. It's like, you got to be realistic. And so it's like, how many series can you actually keep doing? And so I have these new character ideas and this and that. And sometimes the part of the writer is like, okay, I'm just going to turn that off and I'm going to do what I need to do, which is finish this book with a character that sometimes you don't necessarily, I mean, if you're being honest, there are times where you're just like, oh, I love this character, but my goodness, would you please do what I want you to do so I can finish this book? And they don't always cooperate. And it's hard to stick with it sometimes and to keep it fresh and to come up with interesting angles that don't feel like other books out there.
I'm actually really glad to hear that your characters don't appreciate your direction either. Cause I've had,
no, they don't. They don't listen.
I've had them, my structure. So I before I get started at, like you said, manufacturing, I will have at least a opening hook and an end that, the big climax at the end, and we'll figure out how to get there in between, but I got to have a beginning and an end. And I've had a couple books that are just like, it's all looking good. I got it all mapped out. And the character's like, I don't think so. What if I kill that guy? I'm like, it's going to throw a wrench in things, but
You start with more than I do. I don't even have the end. I usually just do. I literally do the Stephen King way. I'm a pantser. Oof. I've tried outlines. I just start with a what if. And so the what if has to be big. And if the what if is big enough, then you can go with something. What if, like, my wife walks in and is like, got her arm around a dude and is like, I'm leaving you and I'm marrying this dude right now. Like, that's a pretty big what if. And I'm going to have to react to that. I don't know how I react. What does the character cry? Does the character punch a dude out? Like, what happens? Or what if, you know, that's pretty big. But what if, oh, I heard glass breaking downstairs. I run downstairs and two dudes grab my wife and she's in a car and the car's going that way. Boom. Book starts right there. That's a what if. I have no idea who took her. I have no idea why, any of that. And I just kind of go with it. And if I can start with a big enough what if and make it absolutely big, and maybe I've already taken that. Let's add a note. There's a note on the table. I got to get $1 million to him in 3 days or she dies. I don't have $1 million. So now I got to figure out who took her and I got to get $1 million. I got to do all that. And bam, I just go with it. And I just start doing what ifs.
And you just write and you just go.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Wow. And I'm like, well, how would Nick Woods take that? Or how would Danny Acuff? I've tried doing outlines and it doesn't work. I can't. Or even when I'll get them done. I've read so many books on outlining. And like you said, like the characters don't cooperate. And I spend weeks and weeks outlining. And then the character went left instead of right. And I'm like, well, why did I do all that? Because I don't know until the character's there. And then half the time the character doesn't listen. So, I just start with literally a what if. And then, you know, it's literally, I'm just taking what Stephen King taught in Own Writing, his book Own Writing, which is just absolutely must read if you ever want to be a writer. But he says, you know, you got to have a what if, and then got to make it big, and then you got to make it bigger, and then you got to make it bigger and bigger. And so maybe, you know, there's a window near me. Maybe I get a near miss, or I get hit in the shoulder with a bullet, and they grab the wife, and there's the ransom note, and I can't contact the FBI, and I've got, instead of 3 days, I've got 24 hours. Oh, wow. I just made that even better. You know, it's like, and oh, by the way, I drag out as I'm, you know, trying to patch up my arm, and my truck has got 4 flat tires and my wallet's gone. And I know my accounts are, you know, so I've got no money now too. And the self, you know, you just keep ramping it up. And then before long, you're like, man, that's good. And like, this was good enough. I should have written all that down. But that's literally what I do. I just start with a what if, and then I just keep making it worse.
See, that's alien. I can't, for me, I've got to, when I sit down, like my work time is about 6 to 7 in the morning. It's always been 500 words between this period of time. And, but I got to come in every day with the plan. Like here's my orders. Here's the orders I got to fill. I always liken it, and I'm not aligning myself to the level of Michael Crichton. But when you read Crichton books, they read like a movie. Like as you're reading it, you can see that scene in your head and it going in logical sequence as he wrote it. So for me, it's all right. I'm doing this scene today and then cut this scene today, cut. And it's for me to not to have a plan when I go to work, like it's baffling to me. I got it out for you, man. That's awesome. But
like some days I'll sit there and I might write 2 sentences or I can't. I'm like, I don't know what he does. I worked my way into a corner. And so I'm stuck and I might be stuck for a few days. I might be stuck for a week or two. And then like one night at midnight, I can't sleep and I'll have the idea and I write 3,000 words. So it's like, I got to have, you know, I'm not trying to totally counter what I said about inspiration earlier, because I'm still having that forward goal. And what I've learned is, and I've read this in a book about writing, I can't remember which one, because I've read unbelievable amounts of them. But one of them was like, if you force yourself to sit down, and you read the last few paragraphs, you put yourself in that world. And even though sometimes you don't know, you're like, oh, I don't know. And then later you're showering or you're trying to sleep or you're doing the day job or you're talking to your wife, or you can be in the most middle of an important discussion. And I'll be like, 1 second, blah, 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 I got to put something on my phone so I don't forget it. And it'll come to you. You just have to constantly keep entering that world and saying, okay, what if? And so,
it'll come to you
if you enter the world.
I think that's an Elmore Leonard. That's either Elmore Leonard or Wombat.
It might have been, actually.
To go back and read the last couple of paragraphs that you did so you can rev yourself back up. Where Stephen King's your guy, Elmore Leonard, like Rules on Writing, his biography, that's my guy.
That's not a bad one to have right there.
Yeah. Yeah. He's classic, sure. Man.
I hate he's not with us.
Oh, I know. But so you just roll with it, man. So you start with a
total pantser. Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably the most organized I get in my life is like, I got to have a plan. That's the only time I got to have a plan. Like even starting this podcast is like, I'm going to give this a shot. How are you going to do it? I haven't got a clue. I'm just going to go.
Wow.
So, so you've written for the newspaper, you've written, fiction. You've got, which do you like more?
Gosh, I don't know. So it's easier to write nonfiction or to do like my weekly podcast or newsletter, anything news related. And maybe that's because it has a structure, like something happened or didn't happen and or needs to happen. And so I can write that. And then it's like, how do you make that as compelling and clear and enjoyable as possible? And so there, I never get any kind of writer's block or anything with nonfiction or that. I could do that for the rest of my life for sure. And so I think I enjoy the challenge of fiction because I almost said the word gift. I don't want to say it's gift. I think you can learn it. It's just, it's challenging though. And I think, you know, you've heard my comments the past 20, 30 minutes or whatever. And we've heard yours too. We both try the main ways to do it, which is structured with an outline or with no outline. And it doesn't matter which way you do it. It's not easy. It's, man, like getting a book done is a major accomplishment. So I don't want to dismiss that accomplishment for anyone out there who's nearly done or written one book. Like you do get better at it, but it's hard to write a book.
But and the thing I always come back to that whenever anybody says something like that, it's like, I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you do this. And I always just point out that George Lucas, everything he did came from some wild idea that he just had. Like, what about a robot? What about a robot, a magician, and a scoundrel? What can I do with this? And now we have 50 years later, an entire theme park dedicated to him. You know, sold his one idea for $4 billion, and it's like it's all in your head. It all came from his head. I mean, he's really good at referencing his sourcing material with. You know, Man with a Thousand Faces and Hero's Journey and Joseph Campbell and all that. But still, Joseph Campbell didn't think of Luke Skywalker. He did. And it was just a one idea based on a couple of characters and boom. But it only came from that dude's head. I think that's the best part of it. The best part is that, that 100,000 words is all stuff that just came from some crazy idea that you had.
Right. Absolutely.
I experimented with high fantasy. Wraith of Sheltermount, Die Hard in a Castle, basically. I wanted to try it because I love the swords and I'm not a horse guy, but I love the swords and all that good stuff. So I'm mowing my lawn one day and I'm listening to Korn and it was Coming Undone. Just started playing there it was. It just stopped. So I'm disgusting. It's like August in Georgia. Go into the house, grab the notebook, and I whip past Erica, and she's like, "You're disgusting." I'm like, "One second," scribble down half an outline, run back out to spend the next 2 hours mowing the lawn. But it's like, but then 100,000 words later, it's like, "Oh, that was fun. Where'd that come from?" You know,
right?
That's all just.
Well, that's funny you mentioned that. And see, that was the point I was trying to get across not too well earlier. Is I've got 30,000 words of a fantasy one myself, and it's like, okay, how many genres are you going to try to do? Because you have no name, you have no base of audience, and you'd be starting back at square zero. And so do I still want to write that? Yeah. Am I still going to? Yeah. But I need to do what I need to do first, which is finish up this Nick Woods book. And so, I don't know. It's I don't know the right answer sometimes, but
I've just been having fun with it. I figured once I wrote the first one, like, that's fun. Let's do the next one. And it was probably 5 books in where I was like, I should do a series. I think it'd be fun to do a series. So I'm going backwards.
And, yeah. And series is where it's at because, people always say, let me think of the name of the character. Oh, the Lone Ranger, like an old Western. I don't even remember how many years that recorded, but you could almost insert any character as long as it isn't some really famous series of movies that's on like Netflix. But basically no one can remember a single episode of The Lone Ranger, but you could tell people about The Lone Ranger and they're like, yeah, I've heard of him, or I read his books, or I love those movies. Or and so people don't remember. People want to re-enter a world, they want to re-enter, they want to get to be with the same characters over and over, and that is the path of success. We all know that. And it's just got to be disciplined, because as a writer, our brains are scattered and we want to run left or right. And we want to do what we want to do versus what we should do, which is finish that next book on that series. So it takes some discipline to do that.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I agree. And it's I'm better at it now. But for the first couple, I was like, I'm gonna try this. I'm gonna try that. And this is fun. I'm not writing fantasy anymore. That was too much work.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I wouldn't want to try to compete with fantasy writers. Can just, my word, their production is just unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah, that's yeah. I had to. I literally spent 8 hours one day researching horse terminology, tack terminology. Just to take my characters on a 3-page journey from one freaking castle to a walled city. And I was like, it's so much easier just to look at, I'm going to go to the Glock webpage and I'll know everything I need to know what I'm going to outfit my guy. That's true. With, you know, yep.
It's just, but as a writer, it's hard, yeah, because you're interested in things you don't know. It's fun to,
oh yeah.
I mean, I don't know. That's what's challenging.
But, yeah, the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about the podcast, but before I do that, I got through Takedown and, Acuff, Danny Acuff, like you talked about him a little bit earlier, but that's just an authentic character. I mean, right from the start, the personal stuff that he comes in with, which is the personal stuff, kind of leads him to where he ends up being. And it's just, you feel so bad for the dude right from the start. And it's like, oh man, but then he turns it loose and is like, oh, okay. Yeah. We're going to have fun. Yeah. You know? So
well, thank you.
How did you, so you said Woods came first. What made you want to jump into the crime thriller?
Yeah, I think I love to read Robert B. Parker. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He wrote, probably 30 crime books. And so I always knew I at one point wanted to write some crime stuff. And I think so with Danny Acuff, I kind of sold myself to try to make something that would be genre popular. And what I mean is, Nick Woods, people say the reason the Nick Woods series does well is he's not like a Jason Bourne Superman. He's just a Southern dude who's tough. And he's very real. The first Western, or the only Western I've had finished, but it's called Little Man and the Dixon County War. He's a short dude who's young. And I'm like, what if you took this guy who's super young, like 24, a little war veteran from the Civil War, but he's undersized. No one takes him serious. And throw him in this unbelievable situation. So I had a series or a number of characters that didn't fit the mold, so to speak. And for whatever reason, one of my readers was like, man, these characters are great and they're real. But like, yeah, you know, sell out for once. Create an amazing character. And I'm like, okay. So I had this idea of the person I kind of based him on. And I'm like, okay, I've met dudes like Danny Acuff. There are dudes like that out there. So they exist. And, you know, if you read some of the David Baldacci and other authors, I mean, there are characters like Lee Child. The Big Dude series, those work. For whatever reason, they do work. And I'm like, that's it. Okay, I'm going to make a big dude who's muscular, who's tall, who's great looking. But I gotta put him through some serious things and break him down. And so that's what I did. So that is probably, he's probably, I hate to say I sold out, but I literally wanted to create a character that, you know, that the women would be like, oh man, like that's, he's amazing. And I get those emails from some female readers, and also that the dudes would be like, I've known a few guys like that and I love and hate them because I'm not them. And so that's what Danny Acuff is.
Yeah, I thought the exact when in this is not a huge spoiler, but when he goes and buys Miss Kitty and the Beagle at the same time,
yeah,
just because he's pissed off and I'm gonna get a cat and a dog. And he just,
right, yep.
It was like, we're solving a murder here, bro. And he's like, it's okay. I'm gonna go to the pound. I'm gonna go get a cat and a dog. I'll be right back. We'll pick this up in a minute.
He's lonely. Yep. Yeah. Well, and I try to put him through that because, as you get older, we talked about when you're young, you can live just on adrenaline and like climbing the ladder. But, you know, the guy at that point had gone through, you know, basically a divorce is a death in a family. And so like he had been through the worst thing that emotionally a person can go through, and he had been stomped by life. And it's like, man, what do you do at that point? Well, I mean, you can become a bad person and just live on the dating scene and in bars, I guess, or you can like adopt a dog. And I'm like, a guy like Danny, who has a big heart because he's a great character, he's probably got a bigger, better heart than I do, is going to go to the pound to adopt a dog that he wants. And he's probably going to see a cat that he knows isn't going to get adopted. And he's probably going to adopt the cat too, because that's what a great person does. And I've had so many people comment about that. And you know, it really is true that if you add pets to books, I mean, obviously they can never pass ever, so make sure they're not too old, but yeah, people love careful. It because yeah. people relate to it. I mean, how many people do you know that don't have either a cat or a dog? Very few people. Everyone has one or the other. It's their companions in the world, and so they make people seem real.
Yeah, my, at least that's my actually opinion. my old man just 2 minutes ago stopped like laying his head on my lap because I was ignoring him. He gave up. He's sleeping next to me now.
So you can relate to you got the big yeah. heart too.
I got my big old dog. But one thing that was interesting as you built that character, the fact that he has an out the entire time. Like, cause he, you know, by all rights, even his new boss says he was in Memphis. He was a detective in Memphis, top of his game, has buddies in the, what do they call it? Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, TBI.
Yeah.
So he's got an out. Like he could go back to being on the varsity whenever he wanted. And
right. That's true.
Just staying the course though is an interesting shred. Cause it's always in the back of my mind. I'm like, dude, you could go back to the big city and be kicking indoors anytime you want. And instead, you're dealing with these guys, you know.
Right.
But it's always sitting there.
But how awesome is that though, you know?
Yeah.
Because in most movies, in most of life, people are so self-centered that they do go back to that or they do that. And but it, like, what does a great person do? A great person who signs up to do something finishes a job. And so he's gonna finish the job. Yep. He's loyal. Yeah, I mean, loyalty matters.
And I like that shred. I like that. That's it's a minor thing, but it's a big thing when you look at the character and the way they process stuff. I thought.
Yeah.
But
thank you. Yes. Well, that makes you feel good.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it. I really have. I know I've kept you probably longer than I should have on a Tuesday night, but
no, that's good.
View from the front, your podcast.
Yes.
We were talking earlier and as I start listening to it, the first episode I'm listening to, I'm like, all right, we're going to talk about world topics, military stuff, and then we're going to wrap it up with some motivational thoughts and phrases. And I was like, let's see how we pull this off. And so, so we're talking about tanks and we're talking about Putin lying and we're talking about vetting intel sources. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to make you guys feel good. And I was like, I can't wait to see this. And you pulled it off. You're like, after you start bringing in the positivity, I'm like, you know what? This is a very unique pot. Like this works. This works really well. It was funny, man. It's an interesting, very interesting take, but I've enjoyed it. So how'd you get into that game?
Yeah. So, man, you know, I went to a rough inner city school and, you know, I come from a family that doesn't have a lot of money. And so, I've always had people that I looked up to, mentors, heroes, people I've never met, and books helped a lot too. And I always just kind of told myself that, like, I mean, it's easy to influence someone if you take the opportunity to do it. And so I've always tried to be an inspiring person. I've always fed off of other people's podcasts and inspiration, whether it's like Jocko, or we could just make a list of people that I'm sure everyone would be like, yeah, that person. And so I'm like, I want to, part of the podcast is about trying to unite America. I think that's huge and very important. We're so divided. I really am big on, you know, reading Roman history, and that's how that empire fell. And I'm not saying we're an empire, we're you know, a republic or a democracy, but we're very divided and it scares me sometimes. So it's like, you know, we've gotten away from some of the truths and the reality. So I'm like, okay, let's do like a news type thing that is based on kindness and understanding. Let's do something that's very steady, that's not over the top, trying to get, you know, viewers, which is the opposite of almost every podcast out there that's anywhere near news based. People take things out of context. So I wanted it to be very steady. I wanted it to try to unite the country. And then I obviously wanted to highlight the military, because the military, they've had issues recruiting. They don't get enough credit for all the sacrifices they're making. And so I did all that and I'm like, but dang it, I want to motivate people too. And so do I want to do a separate podcast? And then I'm like, you know what? Jocko, when he does a 3-hour podcast, he may spend the last 10, 20 minutes just kind of talking about some of the things he's doing, this or that. I'm like, I'm going to do it. Like, if people don't want to listen or if they want to stop it, that's great. I have no, you know, the space and the airtime's free. Every week, right. I'm going to throw some motivation in there. And so I just throw it in there. And then I jokingly say, for some people, that's the best part of the show. So I just try to pull it all together. I just try to be a good dude, and I'm trying to make a little bit of an impact on the country. So,
yeah, man, that's and that's, like I said, that's the reports that you've gone into aren't ones that we're going to see snippets of on Fox News or CNN. They're technical details that can enlighten the guy who's stuck, you know, scanning Drudge Report saying, holy crap, the clock's ticking down to, you know, we're at 90 seconds to midnight or whatever on a doomsday clock.
Yes.
You can be like, no, this is actually what's going to happen. We're going to give them these tanks. This is what they do. This is their technical specifications. This is why we're going to outrun or outfight. And I'm,
right.
And it's like, you don't, it's the best thing about podcasting, because we can go into those details and you can add a little context to the nonsense that people see on the actual, on
that's
the news.
That's the perfect word. Yep. Nonsense. You know? And they also, you know, they hype up stuff. Will we go to war with this, or will Russia launch a nuke? And it's all scary. And so what happens is people will watch that, and then they get very, I mean, like if you're an average mom or dad who's worked 8 to 5 that day and you got 2 kids you got to deal with and everything else, you flip the news on and it's like, well, Putin fire a nuke, escalation is dangerous, blah blah, and they got these flashing graphics and it's all scary and you're just like, ah, I can't control that, I'm just going to turn it off. And so it turns people off, it makes people disengage, or they get addicted to it, and so every day the news has to hype it up like it's a drug so they can get a dopamine hit. And I'm like, this is wrong. We have to have engaged voters, we have to have an informed democracy. And I just, you know, maybe it's the 27-year-old who thinks he can launch a weekly newspaper, but I'm like, I have been quiet about this for, you know, 5+ years, and the things have just gotten worse and worse. And finally I was like, I have the tools to put out a weekly thing. Let's just do this and see what happens.
Yeah. You were talking about the, you were talking about earlier, you know, the, that brotherhood built on suffering and accomplishment that, you know, you and your people had when you guys were all serving together, that shared direction, shared accomplishment, shared suffering. If you could somehow overlay that over American society, that's if everybody could be on the same page and everybody feel a part of, you know, the American experiment, I don't know how you capture that, but like you said, there's that culture in the military is just different, and it's driven, and it's shared. And I don't know how you fix that fracture in society, but
well, the thing is
cyclical.
That, yeah. Yeah. Well, we're more united than we think. Most Americans, 80% agree with everything. But what the news does is it'll take the far right person, the far left one, they'll put out the most outlandish, scary things that either one of them said, and then we're screaming and mad at that side or this side. And the reality is like, even in Congress, like most of the people want to get things done. Most of the people aren't screaming at each other. And if we quit giving attention to those on the far left or the far right, and they quit, we're no longer able to fundraise off of it, maybe we could get more done. And so I just thought, what if I create this place where people can, who have disengaged, can say, man, like Stan is like a voice of reason. This entire Ukraine thing, if you did your research, you would see that for 6+ months, I've been saying all these fears about, you know, Putin using a nuke or this or that, I've just knocked them down weekly. Like, guys, just breathe, calm down. Here's what the experts are saying. You don't see this on the news because it's much more fun to be like, will Putin use a nuke? You know, tune in at 8 and get everyone scared. But that is, it's not. I mean, I would go so far as to say it's not right. It's not what we should do. And so, and if you flip on any cable channel, they're always just yelling and they're fired up and they're just like graphics. And it's like this weird drug or something that people get hooked on, and it's just not the way it should be. So
yeah,
I'm trying to do my small part.
It serves the 20% extremists, 10% on the left, 10% on the right, and the 80% of us that are laughing at that 20%.
It's yes. Like, yeah.
Yeah. So, yep. But I appreciate it though. I was surprised that first episode. I was like, I don't know how this is going to go, but it went. Yeah. So, but well, I appreciate it, man. I'm enjoying it. So I've had you on for like over an hour now, so I should probably let you go. But before I do, one more question. I asked this of my first responders. I asked this of the vets that come up. As a vet, what would you say right now to a 17-year-old kid standing out in front of the recruiter's office? What would your advice be?
And is this, has the kid already decided he wants to join, he or she wants to join, or they're on the fence?
He's at one of those mall ones where all of them are bannered across, all of them. Even Space Force has got their guy in there too.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I would say go talk to him, do your research. Don't feel pressured to do anything, but serving is an amazing opportunity. And so I think if you talk to people who have served, very few regret it. It makes us who we are. And it's not always going to be fun. It's not always going to be easy. But if you're not sure what you want to do in life or what direction you want to go, it's not the worst thing to do. So, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. It'll make you a better person for it, no matter which one you choose. So
absolutely.
Yep. But awesome, man. Well, it's been a good talk. I've enjoyed talking to you. And before I let you go, any socials, your website, stannermitchell.com, where else can people find you?
And so you can just Google me on any, you can obviously Google my name on Amazon. You do have to include the R. So I hate having to include the R, but Stan Mitchell is apparently a popular name. So you have to look on Amazon for Stan R. Mitchell for any of the books. And you can find me on any podcast channel. Just search either Stan or Mitchell, or The View from the Front should come up. Or you can go to that website. It's actually hosted on a Substack page. So it's stanormitchell.substack.com. Again, you can Google that as well. All that stuff's out there. I live on Twitter. I've got an Instagram page but I stay on Twitter because Twitter is a good place to engage, and people are throwing food left and right. And it's like, come on guys, like, I'm the weirdo who's like the centrist in the middle. Who's like, can we all get along? And because people get hooked on the adrenaline going back and forth on there too. So
yeah, people have to get fired up on that one. But
yeah, they do. You got to enter at your own risk. Most people are just lurkers on there. They just read.
That's
comments,
that's my move. Every now and then I'll get triggered and post something stupid and snarky. And I'm like, and I'll be like, we don't do that anymore. Stop, delete.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. You do have to be careful. And some people are really good at, like, some of those on there are better at fighting than you are, at least verbally in 140 characters. And they, even myself, they will like pull me in, and sometimes I'll, you know, end up deleting a tweet later but most of the time I just don't engage. But I'm like, I look at all of them as like, this is an opportunity to show how maybe we should try to act. And so it's like, how can I just remind people that, like, hey, I just got punched and I'm going to turn the other cheek, or I'm going to tell this person that I love them and that I love America and that I'm glad they're engaged. And that's hard to do sometimes.
Yes, it is.
Especially as a prior Marine, but we can try.
I find myself like, if I catch myself starting to engage, I just get that dirty feeling. I'm like, I'm not being a part of this, and just sweep it right.
That's probably the right move.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But yeah,
I'm naive enough to think I can influence people. So I'm just like, if I'm nice enough to them, and every now and then, you know, there will be people who would just rake me over the coals. And every now and then it happens enough that, you know, I've been on Twitter for, I guess 10 plus years or something, but I will get followers that way who a week or two later will be like, man, I'm sorry I said that. I was a little hot that day, and you were right, and you should be calm. I mean, I need to be calm. And I'll be like, hey man, sign up for the podcast. Like, let's all just tone it down. And I really do believe change begins with all of us. And so, like, you know, a lot of us, we blame everyone else. And then you go look at someone's Twitter feed and you're like, dude, like, you're throwing haymakers in here. And you said that person's a, you know, traitor or whatever, and accused him of treason. Like, come on, man. Like, are you a part of the problem? Like, we can all hold back and be a little nicer.
Yeah. Just unplug.
Most Americans are good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The 80% of us, most of them have common sense.
Yes.
You know, we gotta put our arms around that other 20% and tell them it's gonna be okay.
Yep. I need a little loving.
That's right. But thanks for joining me, man. And
no, I'm honored. I really appreciate the invitation.
Awesome. Don't forget, everybody, like and subscribe to TCP. Get a free ebook. Just hit me up at the email or the IG, and all that'll be in the show notes. And thanks to Crush Limbo for the music. And you guys have a great one.